Welcome to the CSIS Cogit Asia podcast, where we think deeply and reflect on policy in Asia. I'm your host, Colm Quinn. We'll start, as we always do, with the region's news. In China, a total of 6 people were killed on Wednesday by a series of 15 mail bombs detonated at multiple locations across the southern part of the country. State media said that the bombs were dropped off by express delivery packages on the eve of China's National Day. In Tokyo, a government spokesperson refused to comment after news came out this week that China arrested 2 Japanese citizens for espionage in May, one near a military base in eastern China and the other near the North Korean border. Japan's government denied that it spies on foreign countries. In Seoul, South Korea expressed hopes that the 2 Koreas would hold October reunions as scheduled for families separated since the Korean War. The reunions were one of the items for follow-through in an agreement reached in August to lower tensions with North Korea. In Southeast Asia, peace talks hosted in Chiang Mai, Thailand, between 19 armed factions residing in Myanmar and the Myanmar government broke down this week. 10 of the groups, including the well-equipped Kachin Independence Army, declared that they would not sign the National Peace Accord, which has been championed by President Thein Sein following an extended ceasefire. And that's the news. This week, we had the opportunity to host Ambassador Derek Mitchell, the US ambassador to Burma, or Myanmar, at CSIS. Myanmar plans to hold crucial elections in November following a period of opening up and nascent democratization after decades of military rule. My colleague, CSIS Asia Policy blog editor Jeff Bean, sat down with Ambassador Mitchell to get his views on the challenges Myanmar's people face in the upcoming election and what the United States is watching.
Hi, my name is Jeff Bean. My guest today is Ambassador Derek Mitchell, U.S. Ambassador to Burma. Derek, we're preparing for, or at least Myanmar and Burma are preparing for elections on November 8th. How important are these elections to the country's reform process?
Well, they're critical. We have been engaged in a reform process as partners in reform, the United States has, for the last 4 years or so. We've seen several changes on the ground, change in tone, opening of the society. But the real mark of reform, democratic reform, will be elections and a democratic process that is open, that is inclusive, that is transparent, and that results in a credible election that leads to a transfer of power to those chosen by the people. So this is a major marker in the process of democratic change, though it's not the only mark of democracy in the country.
What are the main challenges that could hamper these elections from being relatively inclusive, transparent, and credible?
Well, there are endless number of things that we're concerned about with these elections. Everything from the voter lists, whether they are truly inclusive in who they have as voters. If people show up on election day, they need to be able to vote. Will there be intimidation? The involvement of religion in politics we're concerned about. Whether there'll be intimidation at local levels based on religion. Advance voting, the fact that in the last elections in 2010, there were a wave of votes that came after the balloting from military and others that can sway results. So it's everything from the campaign period to election day to the transfer of power to a new government that we're watching very, very closely.
How concerned should we be that many minority Muslim candidates have been disqualified and that most of the Rohingya minority have been disqualified from voting?
Yeah, this is a very serious issue. When you disenfranchise a population that previously was enfranchised, when you disqualify candidates for reasons that are not transparent, that are not clear, that are not being discussed or explained publicly, that's a big deal to the transparency and the credibility of an election. So we've made that clear. We've been public on that. But we will watch the entire process right through election day, and we'll have to take that into account.
From your perspective, what is the U.S. doing to support the elections and ensure that they're as good as they can be going forward?
We are very much engaged in being partners in this election. We have the National Democratic Institute, the International Republican Institute, the Carter Center, IFIS. We are supporting others. Other countries are supporting their own national groups to come and assist the Election Commission in doing their job, political parties from understanding their roles and responsibilities, including party agents on Election Day, civil society to do voter education, to be domestic observers of the polling station on Election Day. And there'll be international observers coming in around election time as well. So this is a full court press by the United States and by the international community to demonstrate our commitment to a good election and to help them build their capacity so they are confident that what comes out of this election is reflective of the will of the people, which is the foundation of true stability and reform in Myanmar.
Derek, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And that was Ambassador Derek Mitchell. Next, we turn to Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's visit to the United States to address the UN General Assembly and meet with CEOs of leading US tech companies to discuss opportunities for investment in India. We spoke with Rick Rosso, the Wadhwani Chair in US-India Policy Studies, about Modi's visit and what he accomplished to advance US-India relations.
Hi, my name is Jeff Bean. I'm the editor of the CSIS Asia Policy blog, Khajiit Asia, joined today by our Wadhwani Chair in US-Indian Policy Studies, Rick Rosso, to discuss Prime Minister Narendra Modi's visit to the United States, specifically to visit New York and then out west to Silicon Valley, and then back, as you pointed out, Rick, to New York for the UNGA meetings. What were some of Modi's goals on this trip?
Well, there's two main things that Modi was here for. The first and foremost, and you can tell by all the CEO interactions that he had, he's trying to drum up investment. He thinks the time is right. The China luster is fading a little bit. And at the same time, India is supposed to be among the fastest growing large economies in the world this year. So even if maybe there hasn't been quite enough deep reforms done, he feels he's got a pretty good story to tell. The second thing is to, you know, to further deepen the relationship that he has with President Obama. And, you know, really that at the end of the day is to try to continue to keep China on its toes a little bit in that growing rivalry, which I don't know if China even yet recognizes as a true rivalry, but still it certainly is at the front and foremost of Modi's mind.
And do you think that he was able to meet his goals over the course of his meetings with CEOs in New York and then out at Silicon Valley?
Well, the meetings with CEOs, you know, I think ultimately, you know, we're not going to be able to really judge that until at some point in the future if we see that the foreign investment and trade numbers start to tick up. But I think the fact that he was able to get so many high-level meetings with so many CEOs on both coasts, I've never seen such a dramatic outreach by an Indian leader. There really has never been to the business community quite like this. So successful in terms of he got all the right people, all the right appointments in the right rooms. On the strategic front in the meeting with President Obama, I don't think any of us expected any grand pronouncements. It's the third summit they've had in a year. And so I think, you know, for that, you saw some small mentions at the conclusion that they were looking to develop economic ties. They wanted to find a solution for the upcoming environmental talks and some other issues, India pressing for America's continued support for the arms control regimes. So no grand pronouncements, just maintaining the relationship with the president.
Now, one of the issues in the background of the course of his visit to the UNGA, of course, is India's diplomatic efforts to try and secure a seat on the UN Security Council, specifically a permanent seat, which would require some sort of reform of the way the current system is set up. How much traction do you think India has picked up in this effort?
Well, I think if you were to poll around the world, few countries would deny that if there was going to be a bit more of an opening, that India wouldn't have a pretty big stake and be one of the credible claimants to being added to the Security Council. But unfortunately, one of the countries that would definitely try to block that is already on, which is China. And we still don't know for sure, when push comes to shove, whether Russia would support as well. I think, you know, some countries would prefer to keep it a small club. And again, you know, China is the regional rival. They would want to keep India out for as long as they can. Plus, you know, the other short list of claimants would probably include Japan as well. And so for China, any kind of an opening, you know, there's a potential that you might see a few countries brought on the Security Council that China would prefer not to have added on. From the American perspective, you know, I think our government has voiced its support to include India as part of a reformed UN Security Council. And the way that I look at it from here is, you know, there's kind of two paths. One is, you know, do we really come out hard charging and press for it with all of our strength? And I think we're not quite at that point yet. I think we want to see India to show its hand a bit more in terms of how it sees itself as an actual security provider in the region, before we take that step of really trying to forcefully usher in India into the Security Council. Barring that, I think we've got kind of a steady state approach to it right now, which is, you know, we're verbally supportive of it, but probably not yet ready to jump on and take the driver's seat and make this an overriding objective in the waning days of the Obama administration, just because, you know, it's not a gift to be given. It's something that, you know, for us, we want to see countries participate in the Security Council that actually are net providers of security, and it's not quite there yet.
What follow-through should we look for in terms of both the security agreements that were reached as well as some of the trade investment talks to see what the progress is in terms of the relation with the United States?
Well, I think progress on the security front, we really are searching, and something that we at CSIS too are helping to try to advise both governments. We do a lot of basics. You know, we do joint exercises, tabletops, and you know, we've started to dive into joint operations, particularly highlighted by the operations we both conducted after the earthquake in Nepal. But we're looking to expand that. Ultimately, you know, operational. Targets that we both have, opportunities to get our militaries working together, to get our diplomatic corps working together. These are the kind of things that are really going to highlight how far we've come to follow through on some of the important framework documents that have been signed over the last year. So there again, most of that's going to be forward-looking rather than you know, anything that two heads of state can announce while they're at the table together. Would India ever commit something more substantial, troops-wise, security-wise, to Afghanistan? Would they ever intervene in West Asia, the crisis happening there? What kind of capacity do they have to play a role in the South China Sea? We don't know these things. We can encourage for India to take a look at, you know, which of these threats maybe they've got a interest in and operational capacity to actually be influential in. But that's for India to decide. If they decide they want to participate in these kind of things, then I think issues like technology releasability for defense equipment, UN Security Council seat, like these kind of things that India covets, are much easier for the United States to support. Again, on the economic front, from the visit here, the Prime Minister Modi's bilateral with Obama and his meetings with the CEOs. Falls just on the heels of the strategic and commercial dialogue, which took place in Washington just before. And I think in terms of like government, our government's ability to help India with its development needs, the SNCD had a lot of small but interesting points, helping India with smart cities, infrastructure, being more competitive in manufacturing. So in terms of what forces the government has, probably more of those were laid on the table at the strategic commercial dialogue rather than the Obama-Modi summit. But again, ultimately, the biggest impact the United States can have on an Indian economy is what decisions those CEOs that he just spent time with decide to make. Is India the next place they put some money, that they hire some people? And if so, then we'll look back on this and see it as a successful visit.
Thanks, Rick. We'll have to track those things moving forward. Appreciate it.
Great. Thanks.
And that was Rick Rosso. Now on to our one to watch. If you have a fear of heights, a new glass suspension bridge built across Xinuzai National Park in Hunan, China, may not be for you. The bridge is the longest glass suspension bridge in the world and nicknamed the Brave Man's Bridge due to the spectacular transparency above a 600-foot drop-off. Despite the height, the bridge's double-plated glass planking is less than 1 inch thick. Previously built from wood, park officials replaced the planking with glass and the supports with steel in an overhaul project of the bridge completed earlier this year. And that's our show for this week. You can always find more at cogitasia.com and csis.org. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and also check out our Island Tracker and Maritime Specific Analysis on the Asia Maritime Transparency Initiative, or AMTI, microsite. I'm Colin Quinn. Thanks for listening.